Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you from the team behind Cycling Plus, MBUK and BikeRadar.com. Hi there, I'm Tom Marvin, technical editor at Bike Radar and MBUK magazine. In this two-part Bike Radar Meets podcast, I meet Sam Morris, a professional mountain bike guide since 1998, initially in Colorado and since 2000 in the French Alps, where his company Bike Village has built an enviable reputation. He was also the founding president of European Bike Guides, whose aim is to professionalise the role of the mountain bike guide. I've known Sam for 19 years now, having been a paying guest and a cook, providing food for Bike Village's guests one summer. The less said about the fish pie, the better. In this first part of the podcast, we talk about his journey to becoming a guide, what it takes, and the formation of European Bike Guides. Make sure you subscribe to the Bike Radar podcast to make sure you catch the second part of our chat. Our chat took place on his balcony in the French Alps, so apologies that the sound quality isn't quite up to studio standard. Hello, welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. I'm Tom Marvin, technical editor at Bike Radar and at MBUK magazine. With me in today's Meets podcast is Sam Morris. He's been a professional mountain bike guide since 1998 and set up his own company, Bike Village, in the year 2000. He was also the founding president of European Bike Guides, which is an association to effectively professionalise the profession of bike guiding, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. I've known Sam for, I think, 19 years now. I've been both a paying guest. I've also cooked for Sam back when guests would come along, and I provided food for his guests in a kind of, some of it was quite nice, some of it was, you know, we won't talk about the fish pie. But I want to talk to Sam today about kind of what it's like being a mountain bike guide in the Alps and in general, how one could become a mountain bike guide, maybe the future of mountain bike guiding itself and where he sees the profession going, but also the European Bike Guides themselves. It's a really interesting organisation, which Sam has been involved in from the start. So we're definitely going to explore some of those. If you hear crickets in the background, it's because we're currently sat at about 1,000 metres below the Les Arcs ski resort in France. We've just completed the second half of Sam's Trans-Alp trip. It's called the Alpaca, that goes from Annecy via Briançon down to just outside of Nice. We just finished the southern half of that, and we're now back at Sam's home, back in Les Arcs. So, Sam, welcome to the Bike Radar podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Can I start off by saying, as a chef, Tom, you are very biddable and diligent.
I tried. Yeah. I tried very hard.
Effort, 10 out of 10.
Everything else, maybe not quite a 10.
I'd say achievement, a solid 7 at the very least.
My courgette lasagna, we had a guest who lived in Italy. He was British, but he lived in Italy. And he did tell me that it was the best lasagna he'd ever eaten.
There you go.
And I stand by my chocolate mousse as
there
well.
You go.
10 years on. 10 years on. But yeah, Sam, thanks ever so much for sparing a bit of time, some herbal tea and a can of beer, which I think you'll probably hear cracking open later on. But I sort of want to start, you know, how did you start your career? I mean, it is a career now, really. It's 22, 23 years of guiding mountain bikes. It sounds like almost like the dream job. You get to ride bikes in the Alps with hopefully kind of cool people.
It is, and it is absolutely my dream job. We'll probably touch on later on, for not at all the reason you just touched on, actually, which is sort of quite a common misconception of bike guiding. Being on bikes is an amazing part of it, but what makes it really the best job in the world is being able to share that with people, being able to sort of add to their experience and being able to really create kind of mastermind, puppet master sometimes, it feels like, trying to kind of, you're trying to orchestrate perfect experiences for your clients, and that's what makes it magical. The fact that it happens on a bike is kind of by the by in many respects. Mm-hmm. But it is, for the record, the best job in the world, for sure. Yeah.
Does that mean that maybe if you hadn't been a mountain bike guide, you might have ended up in some sort of teaching profession?
I think so, yeah. I think that's all the good guides I've ever worked with are either still guides or they're still somewhere in a pedagogical kind of framework. So they're now primary school teachers. Sometimes they've gone into general outdoor education. But that's the passion that, to me, every good guide I've ever worked with has in common, is that it's not a like Lance Armstrong said, it's not about the bike, but it's also less about blood doping when it comes to guiding, and to say more about the pedagogy and just the sharing that passion with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you started in 1998 in Colorado.
Yeah, Breckenridge. Yeah.
Who were you guiding for? What were you doing out there?
Rocky Mountain Adventures, okay. The company were called. I remember applying for... They had an advert in the back of MBUK, mm-hmm, at the time. And that was back in the days when there were about three companies that had adverts in the back of MBUK. So I wrote proper pen letters.
Because
I
didn't Can you imagine?
I don't know. It's ridiculous. I didn't have a computer. I didn't have a mobile phone. But I did have a pen, so I wrote a genuine pen letter to all of them, asking for a job. And I'll be honest, the only reason I think I got the job in Colorado was because by a trick of fate, I have an American passport, mm-hmm, and it meant that my boss didn't have to sort out a visa for his summer worker. So he just gave me the job.
So was that sort of the main criteria for getting the job?
There were, oh gosh, I hope he doesn't listen to this, there were very few criteria for that job. I flew out to age 20. I flew to Denver 1 week ahead of my first guests.
Having never guided,
well, for like mountain bike clubs, having done voluntary guiding for, mm-hmm, mountain bike clubs. So that was, to be fair, the sharing side of the kind of mountain biking was already part of my passion, so I was pretty keen on that. I was looking at outdoor education at the time as something I wanted to get into, but I'm pretty sure my boss wasn't interested in that at all. Mm-hmm. I was just a quick solution to a problem he had that summer. Mm-hmm. And so I flew out to Denver 1 week ahead of my first guests, having never been there in my life. Hooked up with a Kiwi guy called Matt, who I hope isn't listening to, because he was supposed to show me all the trails, and instead he just showed me his, can I say that? He's just got me really, really stoned on the first night.
Excellent.
And basically sort of, he was really useful on that side of things for, yeah, the entire summer. But as for trail knowledge, he was pretty limited, uh-huh, in his scope.
Excellent.
It's fair to say.
Yeah. And did you do that for two summers?
Yep. That was two summers out there. And I mean, a part of me could still be out there. Colorado is an amazing part of the world if ever anyone gets a chance to go there. But I was looking at setting up I'm going to call it slightly more quality driven product, mm-hmm, in terms of guiding. But had a huge amount of respect for the company that I worked for. And at the time there were so few companies around, I wanted to stay away from the States because they kind of had that area sort of sewn up. And I'd previously ridden in the French Alps and had an amazing time, uh-huh, over here.
And so that's what drove you then in 2000 with your mate Stu from the sort of stories I picked up, it was you sort of cruised out, found a valley you liked, and
yeah,
had a go, right?
Yeah, well, it went back to age 17 or 18, finishing A-levels. My brother and my cousin and I had all saved up money on our Saturday jobs and spent a couple of months in the Maurienne Valley, so just about 30 kilometres south of where we are now.
Okay.
And absolutely loved it. That was the big eye-opener. I still remember the buzz of climbing up out of the town we were camping in, up in the Haute Maurienne, on day one, and just climbing and climbing and climbing, having only ever mountain biked in Britain before then. And finding ourselves like 1,500 metres above the town we were in and seeing it, a tiny little speck in the valley, mm, floor below us. And I think at that point something clicked and, mm-hmm, I knew that that's where, yeah, I'm pretty sure at that point I knew that's where I wanted my life to be. Yeah. And the Maurienne Valley, though, is great for biking, but really quite inaccessible. And to be honest, what's kind of brought me to the Tarentaise, where we are now, is the fact that in 1999, roughly, when I was doing all the research and setting up for this, EasyJet didn't yet exist, or maybe had right. just set up.
Yeah.
And there's a TGV station in Bourg Saint-Maurice. Uh-huh. A TGV station's not the word. Yeah, the railway station.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. And I thought all of our potential future clients could come by train. So
foresight into a
21 years later, I think four people have come by train yeah. in all that time, and three of them worked for British Rail or other rail companies, so we're going to get free. So train hasn't quite been the...
Hasn't taken off.
No. But EasyJet did take off, yeah. luckily. So,
yeah, so with a lot of flights to Geneva.
That side of things.
Very handy.
Yeah.
And we're looking back at sort of 2000, what... obviously, we'll talk about sort of how bikes have developed over time, I think, a little bit later on, but what were you riding back then? You know,
I was riding a Lightspeed Obed titanium hardtail uh-huh. with a set of RockShox SIDs on the front, 28.6mm stanchions
mm-hmm.
that I had triple bushed. So you could, at the time, your forks would start flapping after like a couple of months riding them. So you could stick a double set of bushes into mm-hmm. them. And it'd stiffen them up a little bit, like sort of a bit like cooking your spaghetti, a bit more al dente. So I think that's roughly where we're at. And then if you triple bush them, you could turn them into veritable linguine. and I think those forks, that bike, man, it used to do something like, those forks did over 1,000,000 meters of descending, I think,
really?
We worked out once. It was ridiculous. Like they took it. It was awful. It's a terrible bike.
Yeah.
I've still got it. I've kind of done it up slightly to its former glory, and I never ride it because it is absolutely, absolutely ill-adapted to the terrain that we have out.
Yeah.
But it's kind of what we knew at the time. It was either downhill bikes or cross-country bikes, yeah. and there really wasn't that much in between.
And I guess down this way, the infrastructure for mountain biking maybe was less developed than it is now, so you're not going to be pedaling a downhill bike up an Alp.
Exactly that. Exactly yeah. that. There's a few chairlifts open. I'll be honest, when we set up, we just couldn't afford a minibus and trailer. We were running on no money. I was outside the bike season, working simultaneously, running a guest house, working in a wine shop, and working for a comedy après-ski activity, donut descent, sliding down pistes on rubber inner tubes.
This I did not know.
There you go. So like all out with the season, and then doing building work as well. I was working from 6 a.m. till just before midnight in other jobs to sustain the mountain bike side mm-hmm. of things. But the infrastructure, you're right, didn't exist nearly to the degree at the time. There were some lifts that were open, but there were no pre-built trails mm-hmm. at all. So we were just riding, to be honest, pretty similar natural single track to what we do now, just on flat-barred gravel bikes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I first came out in 2003, I think, would have been my first trip to this area. And
Marin Pine Woods?
Marin Pine Mountain.
Pine Mountain.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. With
Muirwoods and then Pine Mountain. They were the models.
That was it, yeah. No, I had some Hope mono brakes on it, so discs, yeah. And I had a pearlescent paint job and I think Mazzocchi Marathon forks with an ETA lockdown function.
Yeah. Or mountain.
Oh, and I got an LX group set for Christmas and my birthday for my parents. So I was running on LX back in the day. Those were the days.
When bikes were awful.
When bikes were awful, yeah.
Yeah.
But, good times. And we always had a thing where, it was you had your saddle up. Obviously, there's no drop posts. We'd have a comfort inch if we were going to traverse. And if someone wanted to drop a saddle, it was always a little bit of a...
Well, and I used to have, if you remember, a free accessory I developed myself.
Yeah.
That I'd pre-make for guests before we came riding, which was a old used gear cables and electric wiring dominoes that you use for mm-hmm. for your wiring in the house. A nut string, we used to call it, so that you could attach it to your seat clamp and up to your saddle rail so you could find the right height. You could drop your saddle. It took the hesitation out of dropping the saddle because you could find the right height again straight away.
As it happens, this is a tangent that we never even planned for, but my girlfriend's dropper post is too long for her bike, and so we've done one of these on her dropper, so that the dropper doesn't extend all the way up.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's very good.
It lives on.
So it's fair to say that back in 2000 and around that time, you didn't have any guiding qualifications. How did sort of things start to change in that regard? Before we sort of do talk about European bike guides, like, was there a point in the early mid-2000s or a little bit later on that you felt that actually qualifications or like some structure towards guiding was perhaps a good idea?
Absolutely, yeah. And right from the start, as soon as the qualifications appeared, some people are quite reluctant to go on the training courses. It's quite interesting. And I've had to suck up an awful lot of training courses over the mm-hmm. years. But what I've learned in that time is that you always pick up loads of useful stuff from every single one that you do. And you should, if you're a professional and you're interested in doing the best job you can, you should be interested in knowledge sharing, is what we talk about. I didn't kind of call it that at the time, probably. But the chance to meet with other people that work in your profession and share your good practices has always been one of the most positive things that you can do for your working life. It's true. In 98, man, there was the Dan Cook and the OTC, there would have been in England, the Off-Road Training Consultancy, I think it would have been called at the time, and which morphed through the years, and sort of these people are all still involved in mountain bike training, actually, a lot of the people from those early days. But the training schemes kind of cropped up. They became more popular in the early 2000s, I think. And the first one I did was the Scottish Mountain Bike Leader Award.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually flew back to Scotland at the time. I kind of regret that I didn't do the French qualification at the time. That was the early 2000s. They just launched their own one then. And I shied away from it at the time because back then it wasn't mountain bike specific. It involved all cycling disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
So you did a load of track cycling and BMX, things that would actually be really good fun at the time. But if I'm honest, it was just that it took a year. And I mentioned just a minute ago, I was working all the jobs in the world to kind of subsidize the company out of season. So I just couldn't afford to do it that way. But as soon as they cropped up, I would travel back to Scotland and do my training there. And it was always, such positive experiences to meet fellow professionals and really kind of, I don't know, just I can't think of the right words, but get together and just share your best ideas, steal other people's good ideas. That's what you do. You watch other people working, doing your job, and you steal their good ideas. That's what it is.
But at this point, there was no sort of mandatory sort of reason to do it. Was it more for your own sort of development interest, or was there a real professional reason for doing it?
So, well, this, interestingly, we'll get onto this with the European thing. Mm. It depends. It changes country to country depending on where you work. So if you want to work with adults in Britain at the moment, there is still no legal requirement to have a qualification. Now, that doesn't mean if you have an accident with somebody who's paying you for your services, it doesn't mean you're not going to get into a lot of trouble in court. But there is nothing, you know that you're not allowed to drive a car without a driving license. Mm-hmm. Well, there is nothing to say that you are not allowed to teach a mountain bike lesson without a mountain bike guide instructing qualification.
Right.
Whereas in France, quite early on, it became incorporated into their legislation. The French are quite strong for that, for creating good legal frameworks for their sports instruction. I'll be honest, for a few years, I guided in the grey area that we were providing accommodation, transfers and all sorts of kind of a whole package.
Mm-hmm.
And the guiding was only part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a few years there, I kind of just worked in the grey area where we called our guiding a complimentary service. And that was dodgy, you know.
It wasn't right.
That's how, but it's kind of, when you start working before there is a legal framework, mm-hmm. that's kind of how things pan out. As soon as we could, we set it right. But
I assume all the other operators, because you're not the only people to run like a British orientated mountain bike guiding holiday company in the Alps.
It was an interesting time. Like, one of the first legal ways for British leaders to become legal in France was to do a walking qualification, the International Mountain Leader, I think it's called in the UK. Over here, it's equivalent to the Accompagnatura Moyen Montaña, which is like a tour guide, walking guide thing. But they do have a prerogative. They're allowed to lead bicycle rides as well. Generally, it's understood that it's not of a technical nature, and the laws have changed again since then. But at the time, the only legal way to, and we're pushing on towards kind of 2008, 2009 at this point, the only legal way to be able to work in France on British qualifications was to do so with a walking guide who happened to be taking out mountain bikers. You could do your walking qualification, tag on the MBLA or one of the British bike guiding quals, and between those two, you'd be legally okay. It's just you've kind of, I don't know, it wasn't the path I chose because it's kind of a backdoor approach, and it just, I've only ever been a mountain bike leader. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to have to learn how to lead snowshoe and walking trips in order to coach and guide mountain biking, which is my passion.
Did you find as you were sort of developing your own sort of professional skills and knowledge that you would see, you know, other sort of other guides maybe doing things in different ways and in positive or negative ways, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's and I mean, as I'm back to stealing ideas of other people, you see other people working and sometimes it blows your mind and it's beautiful. They'll have a whole different approach to something you've never quite had a grasp on, and it completely inspires you. What you would see a lot of at the time though as well, especially out here in the French Alps, was British, I'm going to call them gap year kids, who could ride and therefore thought they could lead rides and thought there was nothing wrong with that. And that caused a massive amount of resentment here amongst the professionals, French, British and international, whatever nationality they happen to be, to kind of have a job that you're proud of, that you've made your life's work, and to see a cocky 19-year-old who can talk the talk, turning up, not putting anything back into the area that they're guiding in and just taking people out riding, cash in hand, and really bringing down the reputation of your profession, really setting you back, is kind of hurt me as much as it hurt. I mean, it kicked off in the UK press. There was some coverage back at the time about it was, and that was more something that happened over up in the Porte de Soleil, kind of Morzine-Leger area, where they'd actually then have the gendarmes, the police, turning up to arrest people that were guiding illegally.
So it kind of had been a bit grey, but then I guess people were getting pissed off and it became black and white.
Exactly. Analog became digital, and you could either be one or zero. So it was time to become one at that point.
I guess from like a UK perspective, certainly sort of back then in the, you know, early mid noughties and that, it was, from a UK side of thing, it seemed like it was just a way to sort of have a bit of a time out and have a bit of fun, but actually it was already being professionalized in Europe. And therefore, you know, with, you know, there's a strong history of alpinism in France and the Alps with mountain guides and all that sort of thing. And they felt they were having their toes tread on, sort of thing.
Absolutely. And they've got a real passion here for quality and professionalism to kind of, it's a bit, and imagine it's because you kind of can turn it on its head. Over here, we're currently sitting on the terrace of a half renovated house, which I'm allowed to work on myself. I've done a lot of work in the building industry, but there's no building inspector turning up to check what I've done. You can kind of do what you want. And in Britain, that would seem absolutely crazy that I could renovate an entire house and never have somebody visit to make sure my work's up to scratch. So if you take the building industry in Britain and imagine people turning up sort of
unqualified, unregulated.
Unregulated is the main thing. Completely unqualified and unregulated, doing an awful job that was actually causing accidents, and that did happen a lot. Then there'd be a bit of an outrage, and that's what happened here. You know, it's quite a misunderstood thing with what happened out here, that the focus among the locals really wasn't the fact that it was going to destroy the industry that everybody worked in. If a load of people turned up and just delivered shit quality work, you know,
Put an explicit tag on Spotify.
The mildest of my expletives. Like, The people that I spoke to that were really worried about it, they were just worried because it was just bringing the industry down. Imagine somebody launched a bike onto the market that hadn't been tested and didn't meet the CE safety standards and was essentially dangerous.
Still totally available to buy.
But totally available because it was cheaper than everybody else.
Yeah.
Because the company wasn't paying tax. You'd want them taken out of the market as quickly as possible. Yeah. That's a lot of what happened in France.
Do you think it drove down wages and things as well? And do you think it created unfair competition because it was unqualified? Or
it does, yeah. And this is where I suspect like some comments might start flicking up below the podcast. I don't know, but the wages thing is an interesting recurring theme I've had because over the years working on the European project that I have, I've helped a lot of British guides get their equivalents in France, and the ones that have got there have been really professional and really worked towards it and really deserve it. But I've also had a lot of sort of on-spec inquiries from people that believe they're entitled to equivalents just because they've done some guiding in the UK, might have a short qualification, might not have anything, and think they it's always the same kind of rhetoric. They just want to work and just want to be free to work. And I always ask them the same question, why do you want to work in France then? And the answer is always the same. Well, I can earn a living here. Like, you've got the best pay in the world for mountain bike guides. And I say, yeah, we've got the best pay in the world for mountain bike guides. And we've got the longest, most rigorous training scheme for mountain bike guides in the world. Do you think that's a coincidence?
Yeah.
And it's not.
Yeah.
It's causative. You know, it's because there's a rigorous, long training scheme and a highly valued reputation as professionals amongst the public that you can then charge the amount that you can, which isn't ridiculous. It's the same as I earn when I work as a carpenter. It's not like you're not creaming it hand over fist, but it's a correct. It means that Ollie, my guide that's worked for me for 10 years, can pay his mortgage from guiding. Yeah. It means you can actually set up sustainably as a guide, which means you can invest. You can really personally and professionally invest in doing the job as best as you can. And that's why I think it's important.
Well, let's move on to European bike guides then. So this was set up. You went to the IMBA Europe conference. Am I right? You have to correct me on my history here. In 2014, and
yeah, it was kind of a follow-on. So from the IMBA Europe conference that year, some of the French and the Swiss. So Julien Rubuffet is the guy in France, and Claude Baltiger, a guy in Switzerland who now develops ski mountain biking destinations quite often in ski resorts. And Mark Torsius, the extremely lovely Dutch kind of head of IMBA Europe, were talking about the need for mountain bike guide instructors across Europe to get together and meet. So off the back of that, they arranged a meeting in Davos in Switzerland for just a round table discussion for mountain bike guides. There was no agenda at the time. There was just an idea. Why don't we get professionals together from all the countries that contain professionals in Europe and just see what comes out of it.
Okay. And you ended up going along to this meeting, making your thoughts known.
Yeah. I was that all turned out quite unplanned. It was, I was kind of the jester that ended up kind of running the court, I suppose. I was invited along by Julien Seb, the French representatives, because they really didn't speak much English. So I was the little sort of, I was the translator, basically. I was the court jester. I was just there to say what the French wanted to say. And the problem being that you may have picked up, feel quite passionately about this subject.
Have you got opinions on things?
I do. Well, guiding especially is my life's work. Of course, it's my opus. I've devoted my entire life to doing it and doing it as well as I can. And I feel so, so passionately about it that I'm a gobshite, I think, on it for sure. And apologies if this runs to two podcasts, not one, because it's something I feel so passionately about. And I quickly kind of hopped from translating to sort of inputting a little bit more and somehow kind of came out of it a couple months later as sort of the founding president of the resultant association that was created out of the kind of the basis of what we talked about at that roundtable meeting.
Yeah. So it strikes. So when we were chatting about this before we started recording, you know, European Bike Guys is now what it's called, and the idea is to create a certification for top level guides. So it's not necessarily every guide out there, but you know, the top level ones maybe who are in charge.
Well, at the moment, yeah, we've kept our remit for the time being, and it may change in the future to the very top level, the kind mm-hmm. of no. Definitely not going to make a Top Gun analogy because that's horrific. But basically what we're trying to do is bring up that top level of professionals in mm-hmm. Europe whilst letting countries decide how they want to train the people at lower levels. So we don't want to dictate how their guide training has to run. Typically a country might have three levels, for example. They have a level one guide, which is people, volunteers working with bike clubs, a level two guide, which might be people taking out slightly higher level sort of into actual off-road terrain, but without that much skills coaching, for example. And then maybe a level three, where there's a lot more skills work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might pass on to the European
okay.
level. And the reason for not interfering too much at the exact structure of the lower levels for now is that different countries have got different needs. So
sure.
weirdly, in, for example, in Slovenia, a lot of the kind of lower level work is tour guides on gravel roads.
Mm-hmm.
So what they need to know more about is the guiding side of things, where they're looking at group dynamics, they're looking at road safety. They've got to cover some mechanical knowledge, yeah, but they're not delivering much technical information. Whereas in Norway, they've got a lot of people working in ski resorts, coaching people on purpose-built trails where it's mostly technique work.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one country, a level one might be a skills instructor. In another country, a level one might be a tour guide.
Yeah.
So we kind of leave that up to the countries to kind of respect the individual cultures and needs of each country, but with the understanding that once you get up to the top of the pyramid, we're kind of the point that you're aiming for.
Sure. You've talked about a certification for top level guides with what's called an EPC or a European Pro Certificate.
Is that right?
Professional card, sorry.
Yeah.
And so that's something that nurses have, mountain guides have, not many professions have. And it's basically can you explain what that is? I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of our end point in terms of the qualification, I think. And it's the kind of the nirvana for a very heterogeneous. Yeah, I'm going to use French words. Sorry, heterogène.
Heterogène.
So heterogeneous, that'll work fine. Across different countries, because, you know, when we came into this project, between the different countries, we had Austria had a guiding qualification and took 14 hours to get. And France had a guiding qualification that took 1,200 hours. So I think that just about qualifies as an order of magnitude of difference,
yeah.
doesn't it? Even in technical terms, that is an order of magnitude, I think.
Again, two orders of magnitude, maybe.
Welcome to comment on it. But that's how kind of spread out a thing was. Whereas the European professional card, like, as you rightly said, nursing has it. High mountain guides, the UIAGM have got it. And that was a massive achievement of theirs. And it means that for mobility, for people working in the industry, it means when you qualify in your own country, you can just automatically work in every other country.
You don't have to take an equivalence.
No equivalence, exactly. You'll still have to register because the basis, and this is something that is a common misconception, is that you'll be able to just slip across borders and secretly work. And that's not the point at
right.
all. The whole point of this is that any given moment, we know who's working in any given country, that mm-hmm. we know the state of our profession because
mm-hmm.
we are the custodians of that profession. So it's kind of up to us to keep tabs on who is where, but that if an Italian mountain bike guide qualifies, would be great. They're not in the scheme yet. That's
all
a
right.
separate kind of issue, but hopefully we'll be soon. We'll see how we go. Would qualify and they wanted to run a trip in Slovenia. Well, then they'd be able to do that.
Uh-huh.
Although I'll get onto that coming back as
get
well.
Get onto that, yeah. So how many countries are involved at the moment then?
We've got about 11 countries now involved to varying. Well, I mean, you could be up to about 15, depending on how
you define it.
Sort of how the involvement's going. But and in those countries, where we're going, some of them, where for the European professional card, we need 9 European countries who specify in their national law that European bike guide level qualification is legally required in order to exercise the profession of mountain bike guide.
Okay.
And that's kind of the stepping stone. It may have even dropped to 5, and so in exceptions you can drop to 5. European law is a little bit less exciting than mountain bike guiding, so I tend to skim slightly more over the details there. And so we've got those countries involved. Most of them, it's often a voluntary system, like in Britain as well. You're not legally obliged to have the qualification before you work, but if you want to have insurance, like it's working in Holland at the moment, actually, the main insurance companies in Holland are now starting to require a European bike guide level qualification. So it's like a de facto requirement to have it if you want to have any liability insurance.
Sure.
And from there, it's a kind of short stop to get it enshrined into legislation as well.
Yeah.
So that's the move within the individual countries, is to get it brought into their actual legislation. Mm-hmm. And from there, we can take it on a European regulation.
So it's very much, there's like a legal framework behind all this. Am I right in remembering that you've gone to court with, at some point, European court? Did you go to the European court at some point?
No, I never did, for equivalence and stuff. Yeah. Is this? Or that was going back. It was interesting.
That was pre.
This was back when stuff was kicking off over in the Port de Soleil.
Right. Okay.
And there were kind of, it seemed like there were two options. One of which was to kind of say, well, we're qualified in one European country, X European country now. And so we should be able to work wherever we want. And that argument works great if you're working in a regulated industry. If you're an electrician, that works fantastic.
Sure.
The problem is, it's hard to apply that argument when there's actually no regulation in the country that you qualify from, because literally anyone can set up a training scheme.
Okay, anyone can give a badge saying you're a guide now.
My kids draw great certificates. They could have been drawing certificates for friends. That's what the situation was.
Right.
The fact that you're legally allowed to do it in a country with no legal requirements for people that do it doesn't really hold much weight. And at the time, I'm a bit confrontation aversive as well, to be honest. That's partly my personality, but I just decided to sort of suck it up and go to French bike school. So that was me.
And you did that 1,200-hour course?
Yeah, so I did the 1,200-hour course, and I think I was the first Brit to do it. I don't know. Maybe there was some that had done the previous version, which was a bit shorter, but I was definitely the first Brit that any of my tutors had come across. So I sucked up a year of living in my van on a fluoro-lit car park on a random sort of... describing it's in Voiron on the edge of Chartreuse, where the monks make as
quite a fun spirit,
a bit like they like to do in Britain, sort of trying to spare their souls by sending as many others to hell as they can. And I lived in a car park outside this training college, essentially, and worked there. And during that time, again, like I've said, all these training processes end up positive in the end.
There was
an awful lot of work that I covered before and other things, but it was still super interesting, and I became really good friends and colleagues over that period with the trainers that were running the course. And they kind of got, it was nice because it showed them that Brits could be professional. Until then we were the cowboys. We were the ones that didn't want to get qualified, didn't want to pay tax, didn't care about standards, just wanted to take the money and run. And by the end of it, we were colleagues, you know. I was working, training on the course, but before I qualified, I was a trainer on the course. And it was such a positive, I helped them out sometimes.
Sorry,
I've maybe overstated that, but it started to be, it very quickly, we're all mountain bikers. That's a lovely thing. When people talk about attitudes between countries, they forget that, maybe I go a bit like sort of misty eyed here, but we're all mountain bikers, and that's more important. Genuinely, that's more important than national boundaries. A French mountain biker has more in common with a British mountain biker than he does with a French investment banker. You know, you always have more to talk about with a group, an international group of mountain bikers, than you would with a randomly selected group of people from your own country, your own town, or your own street, probably.
Yeah. So it sounds like France has sort of been fairly well towards the forefront of professionalizing the guiding, you know, as an industry. Am I right in thinking that when it comes to the European bike guides, it's France has played a major role in its creation and its sort of continuation going forward?
Yeah, definitely. And it's a funny misconception. Like when I was president, I'd so often get emails, and the real common, we've developed a term for it with my French colleagues, which is just French bashing. It's what there's so much Frenchy bashing that goes on in the whole thing. And almost every email would end with, are the French going to accept this when it's finished? And I'd reply, I'd be like, the French are paying me to write this email to you. Like France have bankrolled. There's been people that have put in sort of so many people have put in their hearts and souls to this project. And we've done most of it. When I say they're paying me, I think over the course of the first 5 years, I worked out how much it was. And it was 30 euros a day was my daily rate. But for all of us involved, there was kind of the original countries, which were like Switzerland, France. Oh my Lord, I hope I don't forget any. Slovenia, Poland, Holland. That better be about it, I think. We were all working voluntary, on a voluntary basis. We were all, as I say, we had real trouble with the European funding because when we came to get refunds, we'd been sleeping in vans in random forests and just trying to claim back our fuel money. That was all we were trying to get back. But they wouldn't believe us offer our fuel money because there was no hotel bill at the end of it. And trying to explain to the European Commission that you were all sleeping in your vans, it's not really a concept that they get too much. Sorry, I didn't even know where I was there, but we were kind of on one with it.
Where do you sort of see this whole thing? I think we'll move back towards sort of you and your career and what you sort of think going forward you want to see, and also it'd be good to sort of know how to become a guide, but finishing on the European bike guides, where do you sort of see it going other than the EPC, this pro card, you know, like where do you want it to go?
Other than the EPC, it's sort of, that's kind of an in industry. That's the inside kind of goal to it. What I'd love to see, there's a few things that I'd love to see. This could all go misty-eyed in quite long again. There could be many tangents. I'd love to see mountain bike lessons in schools more often. Uh-huh. That ties in a massive, I mean, this is almost off topic, but getting into schools is how we're going to get diversity in mountain biking as well. We're awful. Like, we have to stand back and take a look at our industry, and we're the worst. Like, on a modern sort of any measurable scale of diversity, we score horrifically. So that, I think, by getting mountain biking taught at a younger age, funded much better, and all this relies on there being a network. If we want to get into schools, it's got to be easy for education authorities to organize mountain biking. And if it's going to be easy, it's got to be a regulated, insurable activity that people aren't scared of. And at that point, you don't want your mate Jed, who's freaking awesome on a bike, to be teaching a group of school kids. You want a dedicated professional who's probably got a master's in outdoor education or something, who lives and breathes pedagogy, to be teaching your kids really safely and competently, and giving a wider variety of kids a real passion for the sport. You know, we love it, but most of us got into it through being from quite well-off families. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not how many, there's so many other sports when you talk to the current champions and they discovered it at school because somebody gave them the equipment. And that's got to start happening with mountain biking. I think that's a real big thing. And I think our organization, European Bike Guides, actually has a pretty key role to play in that, because it kind of creates the framework through which that can happen. If you want your kids to learn to swim, you get a swimming instructor. If you want your kids to learn to play tennis, you get a tennis instructor. Like I say, if schools want to lay on sports, they get in touch with a sort of a local authority, a local association, and they know that the instructors are professional, and they know that it's insured, and they know that it's safe for the people taking part. I actually wrote down some answers to this. I thought about what I wanted. It was because it's such a big question to me. I want, being a mountain bike instructor guide, I'm going to use that term because there's those kind of two sides to it. I want it to be a legitimate career choice for people. I want it to be something which it is currently in France and it's getting there in other countries. I want it to be something you can pay a mortgage on. It may might not, it will never be a mortgage on the biggest house on the block, but you should be able to live off your wages as a mountain bike instructor guide if you could. If you've gotten your qualifications and if you've put the work and if you're passionate about it, essentially. There's another thing I'd like, more things I'd like, a bit like in golf. Do you know anyone that plays golf? They all do like 2 days a year with a local golf pro.
Their local club has a pro, right?
Every club has a pro. And I'd like every mountain biker to spend 1 or 2 days a year with an instructor working on their skills. How much would it cost compared to the kind of the latest piece of plastic that you bought for your bike? It's such a minuscule investment, and yet it brings such huge rewards. And I would like to see mountain bikers, like as a skills instructor, and I'm sure if there's any others listening to this, they'll feel exactly the same. When I'm coaching kids or complete beginners, it's a joy because you can just teach them the right thing to do, the right things to do from the start, and they pick it up so, so quickly. But the reality is that 90% of my job is unteaching bad habits that have been brought in by 20 years of riding completely uninstructed.
I think you've tried to unteach plenty of my bad habits, and a lot of them
so many. and that's like a continued journey with myself as well. I'm still trying to unteach my own bad habits. But man, it's so much fun when you get a group of school kids and you try and teach them a good kind of shape on the bike, and they just ride off doing it straight away.
I mean, last week we were riding, and you know, one of the other sort of guests on the week, Lindsay, was. We spent, you know, you were sort of talking her down a section of trail, which was, you know, switchbacks or hairpin corners, and making sure her belly button was pointing in the right direction to sort of turn, twist the hips and all this sort of stuff. And it's stuff that you've been telling me literally for nearly 20 years now.
Yeah.
And I rode down behind you two guys, you know, sort of backing off, didn't want to sort of put pressure on Lynn sort of practicing stuff, but like consciously being like, oh shit, I need to do that.
Yeah.
And I can get around a corner, a lot, not every corner, but a lot of corners, but it's still having that reminder of sort of that technique of what is the best technique to do it. The more you get it drilled into, the more likely you have to do it.
But it's such a valuable thing you just said as well. Like, I think it's, I'd love people to get into their minds. You know, what you did there by following us down a little bit slower than you normally ride was create a nice, safe learning environment for yourself. And there's so many people want to instantly apply what they learn to the top end of their riding without realizing that to do that, you're going to have to back off and just give your brain the processing space to integrate these new ideas, new skills, new feelings, new sensations into your riding. But it's that, I mean, it's that thing with skills instruction. Because, I mean, and especially riders reach a level where they think they don't need it anymore. And I mean, so Aaron Gwynn has a skills coach. What the fuck's your excuse? Sorry, that's definitely a word I shouldn't use. But it's you know, if he's got a skills instructor, none of us have an excuse. And it's another funny misconception with the profession as well. People often say, "Oh, do you ever get riders that are better than you?" Yeah, of course.
I'm like
a mediocre middle-aged man. Like it happens to me very, very regularly. But that doesn't mean you don't have an awful lot to offer them. And I'm pretty certain that Aaron Gwynn's skills coach isn't faster than. It doesn't mean that his analysis isn't like essential to his progress. I'd like getting days coaching, skills coaching to be part of people's practice. And I'd also like getting bigger trips guided to be part of people's practice as well. You know, it was a funny thing that happened like 15 years ago when GPS technology started coming in. I remember reading articles when Trail Forks was first popping up about the fact that guides wouldn't be needed pretty soon. And I'm like, man, if you think that the guide's just there to show you which way to go, you've only ever worked with a really, really poor guide. It's the value adds. None of them are about knowing the actual, like, any idiot cannot get lost on a trail. Sometimes I get lost. There's a little caveat. Go temporarily the wrong way. But your value adds in terms of the experience you're giving to people and nothing to do with just saying turn left here, turn right there. It's all about it starts from before the ride ever starts. It's the sleepless nights I spend trying to pick the routes that are going to best match not just the skill level, but actually what people are looking for that day, what the vibe is of the group. It's about then matching the experience on the trail. It's about sort of, it's all that puppet mastery. Like I say, it's about orchestrating this experience, this holistic experience, which is just perfect for people. Sometimes it's about knowing which place to stop off to buy the local cheese when you're riding that's going to be open, because they're your neighbors and you've talked to them over the years and they're going to stay open for you because they know your clients are kind of quite into that stuff. It's a stupid little thing. It feels like a stupid little thing, except it also feels awesome when you're kind of, you've just ridden through mountains and now you're eating the produce of those mountains as well. It's in all those little things, and it's in the little bits of skills instruction that you add to the day to a group that maybe weren't ever looking for skills instruction but suddenly find that they're riding way, way better because of a few little insights you've been able to kind of share with them. So I guess, but I'm not entirely unbiased, am I? But yeah, changes I'd like to see is is people in my job getting loads more work.
That was the first part of my chat with Sam Morris. If you've not yet subscribed, please do so to ensure you don't miss the second part of our chat, where we talk about the changes he's seen in mountain biking over the years and the potential impact of e-bikes, as well as all future Bike Radar podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you want any more information on what we've been talking about or more news and views on cycling, check out bikeradar.com.